Good morning. Happy Saturday. Welcome to Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. This is The Money Show. I'm your co-host, James Parker. You've got a financial situation. The next 3 hours are dedicated to you. On GregoryRicks.com, though, a good addition to the blog this week was a column that we found at MarketWatch, and then the staff said, all right, we got to share this one out. This is perfect for what we do on GregoryRicks.com. This is great for the show. This is great for the clients. It's good for everybody. And that is, one-third of Americans admit to making a costly mistake during the holiday season. That's opening those little store credit cards where they're like, hey, you know, if you open a store credit card, you get 15% off your entire purchase right now. And you're like, oh, no, I'm buying hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. Let me do some quick math. Oh, God, I could save about $300 if I just do that right now. Okay, so it happens. I've done it. You've done it. You go, you're going to make some big purchases, and you get to the cash register, and the cashier talks you into it. And look, mathematically speaking, it's solid. Mathematically speaking, it makes sense. When you say, okay, all I got to do really is fill out this piece of paper. I'm going to save, I don't know, $50, $100. And they're going to give me a card, but I'm never going to use it. I'm just going to pay it off first time I get the bill. Then I might cut this thing up or throw it into that tree shredder that was at the end of Fargo, or go throw it off the causeway into the lake. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm never going to use that again. That's not what happens a lot of times, though. Sometimes it doesn't get paid off immediately. Then you got to pay interest. Then you got to pay interest on the stuff you didn't pay off the next month. And then you end up paying astronomically more than you agreed to at the register for that pair of jeans or those gifts if you're buying for other people. Another thing that happens is you don't take that card and throw it away. You don't take that card and hide it or melt it and throw it into the top of a volcano. No, it stays in your wallet. Every once in a while, you're going to be at that store again. You're like, oh, I do have a Bed Bath & Beyond card. Oh, I do have a Macy's card. Oh, I do have this store sales card. And you end up using it again anyway. That wasn't the plan. See, so mathematically, it's a smart move. But we are not graphing calculators. We are human beings. And we have one great flaw, and that is emotion. And I mean emotion, not the fact that loving people is bad or hating people doesn't have its place in the world. But it's when you get emotional that you leave the realm of logic. That's what I mean by emotion. Whenever you have, you know, your little circle of, well, mathematically this makes sense, but then you show up 2 months later and you're using that card again, well, you have left the realm of math. You have left the realm of logic. You are now acting like an emotional human being. Some of these are nasty, though. Let me tell you about the dirty underbelly of the store credit card world. High interest rates. This is basically the part that I saw when I took this article and I showed it to the crew. And I'm like, we got to get this on the blog and we've got to talk about this on the show. People need to hear what I'm about to say in the next handful of sentences here. There's a handful of retailers that charge the highest APR allowed by law. The highest APR, you can't charge 30%. I mean, you can't charge 30% APR on a credit card. That seems to be like some sort of psychological barrier, because there are a few states that do not have maximum credit card rates. So they could charge more, but some states do, and they're like, we're just going to cap it at 30. So the highest APR, 29.99%, is charged by Brand Source, the Big Lots card. Big Lots. I love Big Lots. I'm there all the time. I go to Big Lots like once a week. That's supposed to be the super cheap part. Let me tell you something. If you can't afford what's in your basket at Big Lots, don't go get credit. Go get a second job. Go start washing dishes at the nearest restaurant, or download the Uber app and send in your background check so you can be an Uber driver. You don't need credit. You need another job if you need a credit card to get out the line at Big Lots. Plus, on top of that, they're charging you 30%. Piercing Pagoda. Yeah, aren't they just like kiosks in the mall? Zales, which Zales is kind of scary because, hang on now. Zales sells expensive stuff. Those diamonds, they're not giving them away. There's a lot of stuff in Zales that's over $1,000, tens of thousands of dollars. Let's just say, let's use the $10,000 mark there. You got 30% interest on 10 grand? Holy smokes. They're not even about the diamonds anymore. Can we just get them to put it on credit? Discount Tire, Sterling Family of Jewelers, Jared Jewelers as well, and K Jewelers. See all the jewelry stores in there? You got these high ticket items. And that kind of seems to be, that makes more sense that you would need to put something on credit at a K, a Jared, a Sterling, or a Zales than, oh my goodness, Big Lots. I'm still laughing at that. Look, I understand it's your 10th anniversary coming up and you would like to get a ring that actually has this sizable rock on it. And the diamonds that are in your price range are not going to do it. So you got to take out some credit to get that diamond ring. Look, frivolous purchase. Nobody, air quotes, needs anything that's in a jewelry store. But boy, that you're in a whole different ballpark, different arena, different sport than the fellas who's running up a 30% interest rate credit card at Big Lots. So retail credit cards, let's see, in this Market Watch package, they talked to a guy named Ted Rossman, industry analyst for creditcards.com. And in this report, that's where some of this report comes from. He said the 30% threshold definitely seems to be an important psychological barrier. These cards are issued by banks headquartered in Delaware, South Dakota, and Connecticut, three states that do not have maximum credit card rates. So they could charge more, but they're choosing not to. That's scary stuff. And I've actually been pretty good at that. I have done the thing where when you get to the cash register, they say you're going to get a big discount if you sign up for a credit card right now. And I told myself that I'm going to get this credit card and I'm never going to use it. I'm going to get this. I'm going to pay it off as soon as I can. And then I'm going to cut up and never throw it away and throw it away. And I have actually been able to pull that off right at 100% of the time. I just know I'm an anomaly, and that's not because I'm so disciplined. It's really because I'm such a slob. Whenever they give me that card, I don't put it in my wallet. I go throw it right in the trash. I don't give myself the chance to do it. And see, that's something that I've seen my mom do, my sister do, my wife does it. I'm just going to keep this in here just in case of emergencies. Honey, there is no emergency that requires credit at Bed Bath & Beyond. That's not a thing. There's no, oh my goodness, we're going to be in deep trouble if we can't get some bath towels. So that's one third of Americans are going to make that mistake, if it is a mistake, this holiday season, opening a store credit card just for the discount.
I get offered that. I'm your host, Gregory Ricks. Made it into the show. You know what? I figured out just like the traveling. I just had misjudged the time because of the different time zones I've been in the past week. And it's like, I looked at my watch and said, I'm supposed to be on the air right now. So
now you look like a fucker.
But I was here just said, okay, I've got time. Let me do these couple other things before it's time to go on the air. And I'm like, what time zone did I think I was in?
Okay. But if you show up in the first segment, technically that's not late. You're in the first segment.
Yeah.
I took a picture of Gregory. I'm going to put it up later. He's wearing a crisp new Tigers hoodie sweatshirt. LSU Tigers hat, and he's right next to Mike the Tiger, the giant mascot we have here in the studio. You look like you're endorsed by LSU.
I'm endorsing LSU. I'm dressed for the Heisman event this evening. You know, I'm game on. It's not over. It's still history, a lot of football left.
History's going to be made tonight when Joe Burrow's the first Heisman winner since the 50s. From LSU.
Okay, so back to the credit card.
Store credit cards.
Those are offered all the time, and sometimes people are like, you don't want the extra 10%? No, because I don't want to fool with another credit card. The credit cards I have will work. Well, do you want to use your such and such card? No, I'd like to run everything through just what I'm using. And I really don't say, no, I'm not interested. Well, you don't want the discount? No. Oh, I do want the discount, yeah, but that's not the trade-off I'm willing to give you. Now, being I travel some, and the other day I booked another trip in late January, and one of the things that's kind of important when you travel, hotels, your points, the airline you prefer, or you might prefer a couple, and it's the points, and then my wife, Stacy, well, you should use this credit card's Delta card. And she said, we have that card. Where is it? You should be booking that flight because then we get more points on it. And I'm like, yeah, I think I had noticed the other day that we have that. Well, where's that card? I don't know. I hadn't seen it in forever, so I don't know. Had a question the other day about Social Security. It came in, and the individual said, well, I did what Gregory said, but this happened. Well, what he did a while back was do file and suspend so that he could defer Social Security, but his wife could start the spousal benefit. When as you know, that rule went away a few years ago. And what he was, and the other thing he was thinking, he says, you know, I was wanting to wait and get that 6 month lump sum by backdating when I started. So he did file and suspend. And to his surprise, he said, you know, I got a Social Security check this month. I was kind of surprised about that. Oh, a little detail there for all of you that have filed and suspend is at age 70, your check's going to start automatically because what you actually, in essence, did, you filed for it and suspended it until your 70th birthday. Because it's called file and suspend. You're suspending it for now, but it will automatically turn on at age 70. And he was saying, well, really what I, and the other part of that is, well, I was really wanting to wait to 70 and a half to turn it on, and then I get the 6 months lump sum. He was wanting to get the back pay all at once and then start the monthly. And I said, why would you want to do that? If you're wanting to pile up some money, then just put the checks in a savings account for 6 months. I would rather get the money now instead of wait 6 months. The purpose of backdating is because if you defer, you can backdate for 6 months. And the thing on the age 70, if you wait 7 months past your turn on date, you're only getting 6 months back. You just lost a payment. Or if you forget and wait to say, oh my gosh, I just turned, so I should have started Social Security. Okay, I'll get the back pay on it. You're only getting 6 months of back pay. So if you were at say 69 and wanted to backdate it 6 months, you could get the lump sum, but you can't backdate it any further because you can't get more than 6 months of backdating or 6 months of lump sum. But it was just interesting. It's like, well, I was wanting the lump sum. Well, I would still, I don't mind saving up. I want to pile up 6 months worth of pay. Okay. But you can earn interest on it doing it now. Why would you want to leave it for zero for 6 months? Makes sense, James?
I like the idea of getting the lump sum, but you're right. Mathematically speaking, even behaviorally speaking, if you just take the checks and stack them up on your nightstand for 6 months and then go put them all in the bank at the same time, it's the same effect, right? You're just lump summing it yourself.
Yeah, I'd rather have it now and save it myself. It's the same effect unless you aren't going to save it. But look, he could go back date and get 6 months, but why would you do that? Now you're giving up long range money that you've already built up in deferral.
Well, retro Social Security benefits sound like an urban myth to begin with. I mean, when I started the show, I was like, retro, that doesn't even sound right. And we get calls on it, and so few people know it exists. And the few people that know it exists, so few of them actually understand how it works. And then on top of that, you have no one you can call. You have no similar radio shows to this. There's not anyone dealing with this. So I understand why there's a whole lot of misinformation out there.
There was a case, one of my advisors was working on this week, and I remember, well, I was talking to him about it, and we were looking at what the spouse's FRA, full retirement age number, is, and what the spousal benefit would be. The bigger benefit is the husband's benefit. He's FRA, about to retire, so he's going to turn his on. And the thing is, and I think her benefit's around close to $1,300 a month. The spousal benefit's a little more than $1,200 a month. But if she takes the restricts her benefit because she was born in 53, so she can restrict her benefit to the spousal benefit and continue to defer hers. Because it's so close, it makes sense to restrict the benefit and defer, continue to defer her, so it would be deeming, which means growing in Social Security speak. And her age 70 number is $1,900. So see, it's one of those scenarios. He's retiring, he's turning his own, but for her, it's the spousal benefit and then she bills a larger benefit. So it's understanding how these things correlate in making Social Security decisions. That's why I always say you have to correlate it to your assets. You have to look at the situations and what gives you more money longer range. So by not taking her benefit, it creates a larger benefit, and they're really not giving up much to change that effect.
That is a slippery hypothetical, because when these people go in at full retirement age for the wife and they go turn on the benefit, if they just say, what would our largest benefit be? It's a different answer than what's your largest benefit possible.
Because you have to see, their thinking is what's the larger benefit, turning her. And turning hers on right now is the larger benefit.
Which would have been the right answer.
A little bit less, yeah. But because she's born in 53, she can restrict hers, and he's turning his on so she can take the spousal and defer hers and add, what, another $600 a month to it by letting that defer for 4 more years. And it's just, it works out in the system that way for them. But if you ask them, they probably wouldn't have restricted.
All right, the guy listening right now that's thinking, who can cash in on that? Who can do retro Social Security benefits?
Anybody that's wanting to go back, for the most part, 6 months. It's best for, it really works best for those that are beyond FRA. This is so important that we always, the advice we give, we always go and verify the advice we get. It's that important. It's giant, giant decisions. When you're making Social Security decisions, it's giant decisions you're making.
All right, if you have a financial situation, not quite sure what to do, you're a lucky dog, because I got a financial advisor across the table from me, and over here, cat a corner on the table from me, is an attorney who handles estate planning. John, New Orleans, you're on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, John?
Hello. How you doing?
We're doing awesome. You, John?
Good, good. Yes, that's me. I'm going to give you a situation, and maybe you can help me out. What it is, I'm just recently retired, and I have too much qualified money. I'm getting hit already with an increase in Medicare payments, and I'm trying to see, what is there anything that I can do about this? Should I roll, just bite the bullet and just roll all this money into a Roth, or or how can I reduce my income? I guess is what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, if you're pushing more income in, like you're doing a conversion, you're going to boost income, which also will cause your Medicare premium to go up. I don't know. I've probably talked to people that have a low premium, but that's because they don't have a lot of retirement assets. And if I ask them, if I gave you, let's say you had another million in assets and were kicking up more income, if you had more money, would you be okay paying higher in Medicare premiums? And I bet they would say yes. This is kind of like surprising. You have too much money. Well, because you said that on air. I have too much money. I'm paying higher Medicare. Great problem to have. Congratulations on that, John, because most people don't have too much money. With that said, over time, and I would think of it as tax bracket management, over time, you could probably do some planning, but you're obviously not 70 and a half either, are you, John?
No, I'm 64. Okay. I'll be 65 next year.
Yeah, so you can take less income, but some of that problem for you is the income you're needing to take is qualified money, so it is showing up and taxed as ordinary income. If you had non-qualified assets, you could strategically take principal and defer other income that's showing up as taxable, like using a tax-deferred annuity can shield you from non-qualified earnings in a situation like that. But you have RMDs coming, so you could, I want to keep my income down, but at a certain point, required minimum distributions is going to increase that for you and create more taxable income that would affect your Medicare premium.
Right, and that's what's happening to me. I can see this problem coming.
Yeah, and there is some conversations that you could have. We work with clients on this. We work with high net worth clients. We work with clients that have a lot of qualified money. And that's something where you sit down. I can't just give, and I don't know enough about you or the scenarios that might work, but there could possibly be some work that will help you in the future from a tax standpoint, create more efficiencies for you to perhaps maybe help you save some money. But some of that would involve shifting money in the near future to offset it further down the road. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that helps. And that's something you can call my office, you know, my daytime job, and we, you know, start with a phone conversation perhaps, or come in for a visit.
Anything else we can help you with, John?
I might have another question.
Go ahead.
If I were to put some of this money in a non-qualified annuity, and then I were to defer the taxes on that, what would be my heir's options on taking that money?
They're going to inherit it. They're beneficiaries of that.
They'd be the beneficiaries, but what would their options be as far as taking it out of the...
Well, first off, you were calling to talk, let's just to clear up, you were talking about qualified money. Now, if you're shifting qualified money to a non-qualified annuity, that's a taxable event. So I can't say we would do that way.
Money yeah. So, annuity.
So if we're putting non-qualified money into the annuity and your heirs are inheriting that, your beneficiaries are inheriting that, they have up to 5 years to take that money out of that annuity contract. So they have 5 years that they can let it set and defer, but then they have to take it, and it is a taxable event, and it would be taxed as ordinary income is what the rules for that are.
Yeah. Well, okay. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to Winning at Life.
All right, good stuff, John in New Orleans. Anything to follow up on that, Wes, Gregory?
No, I mean, I think Greg hit the nail on the head.
All right, well, I like the sound of that. Let's go to Dale in Long Beach. You're on Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Dale?
Thank you guys for doing what you do. I'm an avid listener over here for the last few years. I've got a very similar situation. It's kind of ironic that I was behind this caller, but it's completely different. I'm 65. Be 66 here just in a couple of months. And I was going to take my retirement. I've been on Medicare for, you know, the past year. Finally got insurance coverage and got a good supplement policy. Well, last year, I own a couple of businesses. I mean, I do good, but I'm not a multimillionaire. I actually took a dividend from my oldest business that could easily do it for about $125,000. Because I had a tax advantage where I could go on and rather than take a big refund last year for a lot of reasons there's no use to go into here. But it threw my Medicare payments higher, like this caller just called in said. It put me at almost a debt-free situation on home and debts, you know, what I was trying to achieve, you know, entering my retirement era. What's going to happen is my question. This higher bracket of Medicare, do I stay there when I take my full retirement here in 2 or 3 months? Or not full retirement, at 66 retirement, and I'm going to still operate my small businesses. But this is kind of a windfall income I had. Will that Social Security rate stay the same, or will it be reevaluated next year?
It's going to be reevaluated each year. If it's modified adjusted gross income, and it will be adjusted each year. So if income goes up more, then your premium goes up. Income goes down, your premium will be adjusted down.
All right. Does that cover it, Dale, or do you need to hang on?
That got it. That really helped me. Thank you very much.
But I just want to pick up one last thought on the previous caller about annuities there. Not the one that asked about the Medicare, the one before that. And I'll give two thoughts. But going back to the annuity question on non-qualified annuities, a lot of times I get this, that there's this myth out there. Oh, if I put it in annuity and I die, that money's gone. That is a myth. There's when you put money in annuities, money goes by contract, and which means there's a beneficiary designation on and annuity. We favor fixed annuities, which do not expose you to actual market risk. But the only time you use an annuity and you die and the money does not go to a beneficiary is when you're taking an immediate annuity on life income, meaning you're taking a lump sum and purchasing payments over your lifetime without a period certain. And when you die, those payments are going to cease without a period certain, locking it in at least for a minimum period. And my question to you is, why would you put money in something like that? Here's how I think they should be structured. I think you structure like an investment. And we have a lot of clients that use those tools in the mix of what they're doing, and they take income. They take distributions off the returns those annuities are getting. And when they die, that money is going to a beneficiary. The full account value is moving on. So just wanted to clear that up so you don't have this myth, oh, annuities are bad because the money goes away when I die. It does not. Only on life income annuities. Those are immediate annuities. The whole purpose of them is you're giving them a lump sum and they start paying out checks for the rest of your life. And I don't know why you would do that. Otherwise, we're structuring income. Now onto the Medicare premiums and amount of income. So somebody's doing a conversion or cashing a portion of an amount of a, say, a qualified account, you're boosting your income a lot for this year. You have to remember you're going to boost your Medicare premium for that year as well, because your Medicare premiums are based upon what your earnings are. So keep that in mind when you're doing Roth conversions or taking a large distribution, or you have an income boost for some reason while you're on Medicare. So just want to throw that out there.
Are you sure about that? Because I'm being told that, you know, in these Medicare for all plans, that there's not going to be any premiums or copays and everything will be covered from here till the sun sets.
Okay, that's people running for office.
Not the
same
thing.
And they can kind of just say whatever they want. And I'll use Trump as an example. You know, we're going to build a wall and somebody else is going to pay for it. Okay, that sounded really good.
Sounded amazing. But
hasn't played out that way yet. And to do a Medicare for all, which is a myth in the way they're presenting it, which is misleading because it leads you to believe, oh, Medicare's great. There's no premiums, no deductibles. You can use your doctor. That's not the reality of how it actually works now versus what they're presenting it. So just take that with a grain of salt on the Medicare for all, because that's not how Medicare actually works.
We'll give you a wall and someone else will pay for it. The other guy's saying, we'll give you health care and someone else will pay for it. Both of them are missing a few details in the middle.
Yeah, a lot of details.
All right, Wes Blanchard's in studio with us. He's the estate planning attorney of the Total Wealth Authority, and I thought of him when I saw this article. According to a little study here from the New England Journal of Medicine, home has become the most common place of death among Americans dying of natural causes for the first time in my lifetime. They say since the 60s on one of these sources, there's another source in this article I'm referencing from Stat News that says since the early 20th century, so that would be before 1950, whatever it is, it's my life. People are starting to die at home again. Now, I thought this was really cool because for hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution, of course you died at home. There wasn't even hospitals. They didn't even exist. And it was only until very recently that the phenomenon of if you're going to die of natural causes, it'll probably be in a hospital. That's recent human history. That's in the last 100 years. Well, that is showing to be a very short-lived phase because we're now 50 years out of that and people are going back to dying at home. But the reason this is a financial story is because this is a luxury of the affluent. Home hospice care is not free and it's not cheap, but the people that have the means are choosing it over staying in a hospital. And I've got to talk to both of you guys about that. So
yeah.
Before I start whipping out stats and details, what's your thoughts on this new movement, home healthcare hospice, dying in your own bed?
From my perspective, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I don't mean that just in a personal way. I just think it seems like the best place to ultimately end everything. I mean, you're in the most comfortable place. You're around the most comfortable people. it would seem awkward to me that, you know, towards the end of things, you would find yourself in a place that you've never known, that you've never been to, potentially a completely different area. So it always struck me as something that would seem to make the most sense. But I think you're right in sort of announcing at the front that it's not something that's cheap by any means. So it's difficult. But I think a lot of the stats that are in these articles and that you can kind of conjure up online do show a pretty high preference that home is going to ultimately be where you want to end up.
It naturally, it's our preferred status. You know, go out in the lifestyle we're accustomed to. We would rather be at home, but the reality of it is quite different. I have these conversations with people and talk about it. I had a conversation with a lady a few weeks ago. I think I talked about it on the show recently, and at also one of my public speaking events, was I kind of shared the conversation somewhat that she has money. So money is not the object for her, but who is going to make these decisions when you are unable to take care of yourself in your home? Who's making the decisions for on your behalf? Who's going to do that for you? I really don't have somebody that's going to make that decision. And then who's going to make sure the bills are paid with that money that you have? Well, I do have somebody, but I really don't want that person making those decisions. There's no spouse. There's no sisters. There's no children. So that means she's also, and her wish is to stay in her home, but who's, what you're also, when you're saying, I'd like to finish my life, then you've got family that's going to help. Because otherwise, you don't have family to help, then you're needing to be at a facility where there's people paid to look out for you and to make sure you're going to be taken care of. And she has money to do that. And that's what I told her. I said, I'm worried about you as a person and quality of life, that you need to go ahead and make these decisions, because you're not going to be able to stay at home because there's not going to be anybody there to help you. So it's just understanding what our preferences are and what's the reality. You're going to have family and people that is going to help and care for you, that have time to do so. If you don't have that, or they don't have the ability to give that care, you're going to go elsewhere. And it might not be that familiar place, but it's going to give you quality of life at the level that you can afford.
Wes?
Yeah, I tend to agree. And so when we talk about a lot of planning, and maybe we'll sort of end up in a place in our conversation that we're discussing the use of an irrevocable trust.
And in that conversation, she is going to meet with you. And part of that is making sure the paperwork sees that this quality of life goes on. These things she's needing done, where she will go, who's paying the bills, to make sure she is looked out for. And that's why you're here. And that's why we love what you do, is because you can make those wishes happen for us through paper.
Yeah. And a substantial part of that is just getting powers of attorney in place. That's sort of the first thing you want to start looking at. And that's quick and easy. You know, when we start talking about the irrevocable trust, this is one of the first conversations we have with the potential client, is to try to understand what their ultimate plan is. For the most part, if you're planning to pass away at home, you may not necessarily be headed towards an irrevocable trust. There's a lot of other considerations, but that's one that is definitely heavily weighted in that discussion. And ultimately, I think sometimes that's not what's well thought out. I think, you know, the discussion starts because there's an assumption that the nursing home is ultimately where they see themselves. And then when we kind of dive a little deeper and start talking about the family dynamics, maybe things change.
Let's do Robert in Thibodeau. You're on Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks, talking to James Gregory and Wes Blanchard. How can we help you, Robert?
Guys, thanks for taking the call. I had a question about a trust, an irrevocable trust. If the parent and the heirs listed in the irrevocable trust, if the parent wishes to do a distribution on it prior to her death for the irrevocable trust, is that a possibility?
Is the parent the the person who founded the trust, or is the parent a beneficiary?
No, well, the parent would own the trust now because her mother died, and it was for the grandchildren.
Okay, so at that point, I think it becomes dependent on the language in the trust, as it always does, but as to whether the principal beneficiaries, who I'm assuming that to be the younger children, and the income beneficiary is likely the parent. Am I correct in that assumption?
Let's see. The mother died. My parent becomes, I guess, the principal of the trust, and the distribution would be to the her children now.
Well, if she's the principal beneficiary of the trust, I mean, she's got control of that asset. Once she would retain control and ownership, it's free to do with it. She's free to do with it as she sees fit. I think it sounds, I guess, based on what you're telling me, is that with her being the beneficiary, that's really the trust's job being complete once the money hits her hand. And so if she wants to do a distribution after that, it sounds from what, again, you're telling me, that there wouldn't be a problem with that. But there also may be another layer that we're not quite touching on right now that could change that.
Right, as long as none of the beneficiaries that would get the money object to it, correct?
Okay, so that's you're telling me some things that would indicate that there's another layer that to the trust and the distribution structure that we're not quite connecting on. Okay. So I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble figuring out exactly whose role is what here. And again, I mean, I hate to do this and just default to what the terms of the trust are, but it's not a question I can accurately answer for you,
right,
without looking at the terms.
Okay. Let me give you a call then.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'd be happy to sit down with you and kind of walk you through it if you want to make an appointment too.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Now I have questions for you here. Wes Blanchard, someone can reject possibly distributions from a trust?
Oh yeah, disclaim, that kind of thing. And there's reasons for that.
I like that. I like that word, disclaim, because yeah, you don't have to inherit.
Okay.
Something. Yeah, there's a lot of,
it's like IRA money. Oh no, I don't want it. You can disclaim it.
Yes, and sometimes, you know, sometimes that's done for tax reasons. Sometimes that's done because, you know, there's a relationship reason in there. But trust or not trust, that's actually one of the primary ways we deal with successions that come in for folks who don't have a will, okay? And let's say two children and a surviving spouse. And it was everyone's understanding and intent that when dad passed on, it was everything going to mom. But as we know, that's not the case without a will. So what we do is, you know, we counsel with the children and make sure that that is indeed the understanding, and we can generate documents that help transition their interest to full ownership for mom. And so in effect, what they're doing is disclaiming that inheritance.
I see. Well, some of this is new to me, so I appreciate your latitude there. All right. So let's get back to this new trend of people dying at home. And if you're just joining us, it's been a crazy year. It's for the first time since at least the 60s that more Americans dying of natural causes did so at their home than a hospital. And this is actually a hospice. I didn't know the background on it, so I did a little reading up on it. It hasn't been around that long. It's, you know, I just assume hospice has always been around, but I didn't even think we haven't even had the drugs and the morphine and the whatever it takes to pull hospice off. We haven't had that even for 100 years yet. So I guess, you know, as I'm learning more about this, I find out it comes into vogue, for lack of a better term, in the 60s, and it wasn't really a medical thing. It wasn't doctors pushing this or hospitals or the American Medical Association. This was a social movement. And it kind of sounds like the whole thing where people are saying, I don't want to have my baby in a hospital. I want to have my baby at home. So they get a midwife, and then they go through the home birth thing. It sounds more like a social movement like that than something that's medically induced, for lack of a better term.
I've experienced it with family in a couple different ways. We're hospice at home, and hospice, and how I'll define it personally, is to help ease the dying process. What it kind of means, and hospice ultimately is defined from a medical standpoint, a doctor would not be surprised you died in the next 6 months, kind of meaning you don't have long. You could end up in hospice care longer, whether it's at home, and there are dedicated hospice facilities as well for you to go and have that care. You could be in long-term care, but also kind of shifts to hospice because it helps in the dying process. But and that even I've seen that use where the pain of those final hours are eased for you medically as well. Just makes you a lot more comfortable when you're about to die. And I think hospice is a great thing because it also provides counseling for family and stuff and gives them help with this process, because you've got person dying can well have problems with that. That, you know, you're going to die. Sometimes like people are fine with that. Some are going to fight it. And then family has to deal with that as well. And then that kind of brings in why we need estate planning. How is all this stuff handled? How's your stuff? How's your money? How's the bills? How's the financing? We think of couples a lot of time. And where I was kind of passionately talking about it in the earlier segment is, and at home works good when they're both of you are still there. But what if you're the second to die in that couple? Who's there to help you if there aren't extended family members?
Well, this, I want to be a part of this, though. This is something I want to do. And so I look at you and I look at Wes, and do I need to draw up some papers to make this happen? Is there something I need to do to plan to make this happen? Because this isn't going to happen accidentally.
Yeah, certainly that's something that you can draft documents for it and say, look, if, for instance, you have a medical power of attorney that's kicking in because now you can't make these decisions on your own, you can specify absolutely the type of facility that you'd like to be in. But I think there is going to be a difficult point in time regardless of how you plan, right? Because when we're talking about hospice, what Gregory was saying is not out of step with how Medicare defines it. And hospice is really for folks who have a terminally ill condition and they're choosing, or they are past the point of curative medicine and now they're into comfort type of medicine. And that's kind of where you generally get the decision to be either kept in a hospital and administered, I guess, you know, what could be considered some sort of life-saving measure, or you kind of have accepted that you're not going that route.
What's the term for that? Is that palliative care? I had to read it a bunch this week, but I'm not sure I've heard it except for a couple of commercials.
Palliative care? Am I? Oh, is it one palliative? Of us is pronouncing
I had palliative. I have no idea. Look. Somebody's right. We got three of us, all three different pronunciations. But
yeah, if you're familiar with English, 504-260-0995. But that's the difference when you're past the point of
and
being
I
able
think
to be cured.
Actually, Wes is correct. It's PALLIATIVE.
I think I've heard it on TV as palliative, but palliative, whatever. Yeah. But it's the difference. Palliative says we're going to treat you and keep you alive as long as possible. You just have a chronic condition that's ultimately going to kill you, but we're going to keep you upright and as functional as possible for as long as possible. Hospice just says, no, we're going to focus on comfort. The you know, dying in 6 months versus 4 months, what's the point of all this expense and medical whatever? Let's work on comfort here because the end's coming anyway. One of the big differences between America and Europe we'll talk about next, and that's because what Medicare does for it. So you get details on that. Questions, 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker with Wes Blanchard. We're Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.
Winning at Life, Life Financial News Talk Radio. I'm your host, Gregory Ricks, along with James Parker. And Wes Blanchard is in studio with us talking about estate planning. Most just the focus has kind of been on recent discussions and calls, 504-260-0995 regarding palliative and hospice care. When we on the top of the hour, I'm going to circle back around to Medicare premiums for those that have a lot of income. I have more information I want to share. We just can't take it up in this hour with Wes Blanchard because there's too much importance about what we're discussing.
What we're talking about now is hospice care, really, and I'm just fascinated and really heartened by the information from the New England Journal of Medicine that for the first time since the early 20th century, more people in America who are dying of natural causes are doing so in the comfort of their own home and their own bed rather than this funky, sterile hospital with its blinky fluorescent lights and its cold tile floors and lack of decorations and no colors. And it's completely understandable why people would want to go out in their own bed. And one of the things I think about is, did you ever watch that HBO series called Rome? It was big about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
All right. So do you remember at the end when, you know, Cleopatra and Mark Antony have been hanging out and having a good old time and Octavian's about to come ruin it all?
Yeah.
Well, when they get the news that the Roman ships have landed, Cleopatra calls in her little nurses, aides or whatever, her handmaids. And she's like, all right, I'm going to kill myself. What are my options? And they're like, well, we got this. And she ended up choosing the asp. And so right before she gets this poisonous snake to bite her and kill her within a matter of minutes, she's like, wait a second, get my kid in here. Gets the kid in here. And she tells her son, who looks like he's about 10, 11, 12 years old. She says, I just need you to see this. This is how nobility dies. Nobility dies by their own hand. And it is. It's like a little system of honor. Look, she knows she's not going to live forever, but she gets to choose when she dies. More importantly, where she dies and how she dies. That's not a choice most people get to make. That is a choice nobles get to make. And damn it, I want the noble choice too. I want to be able to choose to die in my own home, how I choose, when I choose, where I choose. And it's not a distant fantasy. This is actually possible. I can make this happen. I'm seeing other people do it, so I want to be one of those cool guys.
Yeah, and when you present it that way, it certainly seems like something you ought to have control over.
See, I'm glad you said that, because in Europe, they don't think like we do. Mm. Something's wrong with Europeans. It's like all the people with guts that are European came over here and left behind a different set of people. Hospice is a uniquely American creation. Mm. In Europe, they're still dying in hospitals in droves. Now, part of the thinking behind that and what the guy was talking about here in this stat news column where I'm getting some of this info from is that for the last 50 or so years after World War II, when a bunch of these countries socialized themselves, some of them, you know, forced to do so by the Soviet Union, but others, you know, France, Germany, England, they all got national healthcare systems. And so the natural course of all your medical practices was, if you feel sick, you got the sniffles, you got cancer, you got anything, you go to that government building down the street and they will take care of you. But also the government, once they got their monopoly, they've been really stingy with it. They, you know, we have like our little private urgent care centers and stuff around here. They even have that in Canada. They don't have that in Europe. They have almost no private sector healthcare. It's very small, and depending on country to country, some countries have none of it. So it just hasn't caught on there. There's no such thing as a home healthcare nurse in some of these countries. And the mindset is different. You are not an individual who is living in your own castle by your own rules with your own means. You're just a cog in a larger system, and it's better. What's better for the collective? You go die as quickly and efficiently as you can in this government building. It's different over there. It's not a given. And the United States is doing something cool with this, and I like it.
Yeah, and I think it's worth sort of bringing up while we're on this particular portion of the topic is that there's a school of thought that says that part of the reason I think hospice became more popular here is in part due to the way it's treated with Medicare as well, where if you're a Medicare recipient who's in the hospital, you know, a lot of folks will tell you, and I don't know if there's an absolute answer on this, but that you're not going to see Medicare be paid for each day you're in the hospital. They're not going to pay that hospital per day. You know,
you run out of days on your
right.
Medicare.
And so eventually you kind of, you're not necessarily forced out. They'll never use that term, but they kind of usher you out at some point. And that, I think, sort of necessitated the invention and providing of care at your home, what ultimately came to be hospice. Or providing a different facility that is not concerned with necessarily how long you are there. So again, yeah, a distinction and a point that ultimately kind of sent two parts of the world in different directions.
Oh, and by the way, thank you to the caller who on the last break said it's palliative care. Did I say right? Palliative care?
Yep.
Because he said palliative care and I said palliative care.
I said palliative care.
Palliative care. And that's the correct one, we think?
Yep.
Palliative care.
Or as close to it, I think, as we can get.
And the listener, God bless you, she said, you know, dictionary.com sounds out all those words. Yeah. We know, but they're not always right. I get burned by that stuff on quite a regular basis.
It still sounds like the Macintosh computer guy. You know, you remember when that first came out and the computer was talking to you?
Yeah. Are you too young to remember a speak and spell? Because that's my first computerized voice, and it sounded like Satan was talking to you.
No, I feel like I would have remembered that, and I must not have been around for that one.
And it had that little weird startup sound that... You don't remember any of that?
No.
Oh, man. There's got to be some YouTube videos of that creepy guy. Okay, so what's covered? Medicare, you said they jump in this. I know that's not necessarily the thrust of your practice, but it's from a legal perspective, they're going to take care of some of that. What do you do that takes care of the rest of it?
Yeah, so part of what we're doing is making sure that, again, what we talked about earlier, you have someone who's helping to assist in the decision-making process. That's the first step. You need someone who is going to make sure that the best decision is made for you if you can't make that decision yourself.
Is this a power of attorney thing? Yeah. Or is this, okay, I thought this would be in like your DNR paperwork, your do not resuscitate.
No, so that kind of covers the last and final moments there. Or
what's the real name of that document?
A living will.
Okay.
Yeah, so a living will typically includes a DNR in it, but the DNR is a do not resuscitate order. Hey, in the event that I've coded, as they say, and I'm going down and I don't want any heroic measures taken. A living will kind of maybe goes a step further than that and says, look, if I'm being kept alive via artificial respirator or anything like that, I don't want that. I want that plug pulled. I just kind of want to move on. And then from there, you know, you can continue to feed me food and water or don't. And then after everything is wrapped up and we're done here, you can take my organs, or I'd like to keep them, or I'd like to go to a medical school, or I'd like to be cremated, whatever you'd like at that point. You can provide for sort of a step-by-step analysis through all the different options that you have.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
All right. So if someone comes to you and asks you for this, I mean, you act like this is no big deal.
It's not too much, because I think, you know, people might be shocked at the percentage of people who generally have the same wishes. I mean, there's some folks who want cremation, some folks feel a certain way about organ donation, and then, you know, but the majority of people that come in and they're interested in that document, when you walk them through the situation that it applies to, they say, yeah, that sounds like it's for me. And so we're really just sort of tailoring the back half of the options.
All right. So I'm probably going to die at home. Is that what you're telling me?
You know, if you get your way, I hope so.
I'm working on it. All right. Hey, one more thing I wanted to cover before you have to get out of here and get on with your weekend is something we talked about when you were on the show last month, is things you need to wrap up coming to the end of the year, financially speaking. And one of those was dealing with your beneficiaries. Let's talk about alternate beneficiaries. You know, I was kind of looking back and looking at my beneficiaries this year, and there's been a lot of people that got married, a lot of people got divorced, a lot of people had kids. A lot of situations have changed. So it's not just do you have beneficiaries and are they the right ones, but do alternate beneficiaries get missed a bunch?
Sometimes they do. Now, a lot of the beneficiary forms that we've helped clients with do contain the primary beneficiary on the exact same form as a contingent beneficiary. So they make it sort of conspicuous for you to see that you have a backup plan option here if you want it. But sometimes, again, it's just as important to understand that you might think that the person who's kind of first in line is necessarily going to get it, but what if something unexpected happens? And so you need to, again, have that sort of second step in place. And yeah, it becomes something that's worth checking up on as well.
All right. That's good stuff from an estate planning attorney, also a football expert. What are the odds that Joe Burrow wins the Heisman tonight? Is it like guaranteed? Oh. Is it a lock?
Yeah. I think the odds, I saw it last, which is about a week ago, was like minus 2,000. So you need to bet $2,000 to win 100. Sound like a good win?
No, I heard last week as well that Vegas stopped taking bets on it.
Yes, that basically tells you what you need to know. Yeah, he's going to win that Heisman tonight.
That's bad. Like, that almost never happened. Well, who would be second place?
I don't know. Maybe the kid from Ohio State, Justin Fields. You just don't know. I think he's run away with it so far that I'm not really sure anybody has any real clarity on who the second guy is.
All right, for those of you who want to hear the last hour of the show, but your station's going to turn us off, you can catch it on the Winning It Life app. Download the Winning It Life app. There's a listen live there. And if you want some of what Wes Blanchard is offering, wjblanchardlaw.com.
Yes, sir.
That'll work. wjblanchardlaw.com. If you don't have an estate planning attorney, start your search right there. Commenter on Periscope's cracking me up. First off, his name is Jeff Spicoli. I think that might be a fake name. Do you remember where the name Jeff Spicoli comes from? That was Sean Penn's character in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the stoner guy.
So it can't possibly be a real person.
Well, I'm about 80% sure that's not his real name. But he's asking, maybe because, you know, the show originates from the New Orleans area. He's asking, do you have any advice on where I can score a Popeye's chicken sandwich? And I know Popeye's.
It is not, I was going to say, have they not rolled it out everywhere yet?
Yeah, I think it's everywhere. I got one, and I didn't even get punched in the face for it last week. No one burned anything down. I didn't get thrown into a soda machine. I think some of that fervor has calmed down a little bit. But we'll answer your questions, financial questions, chicken-related questions. We got it all. And I'm glad you're going to go back to that Medicare stuff, because that was one of the things that shocked me when I first started on this show, is Medicare's not free. It does charge a premium. But, boy, the system by which it chooses what premium you have to pay, I don't like that at all. It's a tiered system. And if you go past the magical tripwire, then all of a sudden you actually have to pay a significant chunk compared to what you would have paid if you just had a few bucks of income less coming in. It's a really weird system that is not intuitive. So you're going to have to learn this here. It's not going to be something you pick up on your own. So, I mean, if you want to go do your own study in Medicare.gov, knock yourself out. You'll see how fun that is. You prefer to hear it from Gregory. But we got to knock out the top story of the week. Yesterday, it was such a dominant story, but it is super important, and that's what's going on with the trade deal. And okay, so we have a tentative announcement on, nothing's been signed yet, but they've agreed to terms on part of phase one of a China deal. Yash Trump, what do you think he says? You think he says it's a pretty good deal, it's an above average deal, kind of good, better than expected? Or do you think he said it was great, magnificent, best deal in the history of ever?
It's one of the best phase one deals ever.
And that's going to be one of the great deals ever. And it's going to ultimately lead to the opening of China, which is something that is incredible, because that's a whole big untapped market of 1.5 billion people.
I hadn't even played that clip for you and you nailed it. Greatest deal ever. Is that what he said?
We kind of know him by now.
All right. Now, I like the one thing I do like about that sound clip is he kind of let it be known that his ultimate goal is opening up the Chinese market to American companies, really just outside investors, period. But, you know, we're concerned about us, not the capital investors from Costa Rica. So, okay, if that's your final end game, good. I like the sound of that. Now, can we get on to phase two?
It's a phenomenal deal. The tariffs will largely remain at 25% on $250 billion. They'll be used as a negotiating table for the phase two deal, which they would like to start immediately, and that's okay with me. We were going to wait till after the election, but they'd like to start them sooner than that.
There you go. They want to make a deal so bad, Gregory. I could wait, but they want to make a deal real bad.
He needs something positive out of it as well. He does. But he's not going to do a bad deal. We don't need a bad deal. What, then why did we do this? And ultimately, if he's president, he can stay the course. But what you and I had talked about earlier this morning on the show is they need the food. China needs the food. They, you know, they've said before, well, we're going to buy the wheat and the soybeans and all the other stuff, and then they didn't. Well, they could do without it, but at some point they need the food. They're going to have to buy the food. So if you're going to buy something and you're trying to get some sort of deal, you are stuck having to make a deal, but you're also going to have to buy what you need. You might as well work something out to make you look better, since you got to buy it anyhow.
Sounds like a twist on the Nutrisystem mantra. You eat the food, you lose the weight. You make the deal, you get the food. A little different, but not that different. All right, so the China trade deal gives the markets a great excuse to be positive going forward.
So the markets were up a little bit yesterday.
NASDAQ set a new record yesterday. S&P and the Dow Jones were both in positive territory, almost record-breaking territory. But things turned around on this news, and the markets don't need much of an excuse to take off. This is a hyper little bunch we got going as it is. You know, volatility is winning the day. But Gregory, I'm really anxious to see what happens whenever someone does put pen to paper and we see some of these details, because I'm more interested in that little paragraph where they're like, okay, they had some concessions on intellectual property rights and forced transfers of technology. That's the part I'm interested in.
And I think phase one is agreeing on working on these things to get an actual deal. That's what phase one is, that leads to, this is what we're willing to agree to do to get to a deal. This isn't the deal. This is leading to working on the deal is how it's being phased. That's how I define it there. And there won't, but, and China's wanting the positive side on it to kind of like, if we agree to this, will you not jump us on tariffs again? Yeah, we'll wait if you do proceed and go forward with these parameters of the deal. And yeah, we'll sell you some food.
The tariff threat worked, though. China jumped 2 days before these new tariffs were supposed to go into effect.
Yeah, on Sunday. They have a problem. They need food, and their economy is slowing, and they do need us as buyers.
Interesting turn of events. We'll keep you posted if you keep listening to this show. Coming up next, we had a great caller from Long Beach who seemed to be a little surprised about how the Medicare premiums worked out, and he's not too happy with the jump his Medicare premiums took when he had a little bit of extra income just for 1 year. So Gregory's going to go through that. How do Medicare premiums work? How they figure out what your premium's going to be? How does it go up or down? And is it permanent? Can you fix it? Is there something you can do? You got answers to a lot of these questions, Gregory. Sound like you've done this before.
Yeah, we've talked about it on the show before, but I'm going to give you a little bit more detail, which actually can kind of surprise you in how this works. Refresh this topic for us.
Well, let me toot our own horn a little bit here, because we're competing against nobody for this space. The reason we got this call from a guy in Long Beach earlier this morning is because he has no one else to call. Seriously, name the show. Radio show, TV show, Susie Orman, Dave Ramsey, do they answer these questions? Even when I go to financial shows that take callers, they're not answering questions like this. So when we go into the nuances of Medicare, you actually deal with this on a regular basis with your clients. You have a day job that causes you to have to research these in different situations over and over and over. How does anybody even compete with that when someone has a Medicare question? Why not just call you? And you're about to show them why. Just show them how the premiums work.
Well, example here where most people are from a premium standpoint, let me go, I've got the scale here. Okay, for individuals with a modified adjusted gross income of $85,000 or less, married couples with a modified adjusted gross income of $170,000 or less, that's $170,000 in income, not assets, income. Your Part B monthly premium amount for 2019 standard premium is $135.50. As your income goes up, your modified adjusted gross income goes up, your Part B monthly premium goes up. So, for example, an individual that their income is above $85,000 up to $107,000, there's another $54.10 added to their premium. Now, if it is above the $107,000 to $133,500 for an individual, another $135,000 is added to the premium. So it keeps going up as income goes up. So we had a caller earlier asking about that, and he was kind of surprised at the income. And it's something I talked about earlier when you're doing Roth conversions or taking a lump sum. You know, sometimes somebody calls, well, should I take the $100,000 out of my IRA and pay off my house? Well, that's going to be a taxable event. And if you're taking Medicare and they don't think about it, you're about to bump your Medicare premium when you do that. But that effect is not necessarily immediate, and that's probably what's a little bit surprising for people, is how does Social Security determine if you should pay higher premiums? Let me give you a little bit of timeline here, which I think is a little bit surprising on that. Let me scroll to where they have that noted here. Okay, so which tax, because what they're going off of is your tax return. to determine your 2019 income-related monthly adjustment amounts, they'll use your most recent federal tax return the IRS has provided to Social Security. Generally, this information is from a tax return filed in 2018, which means that's for the tax year 2017. Sometimes the IRS only provides information from a return filed in 2017 for tax year 2016. So if you use the tax year 2016 and you filed that return in year 27 or didn't need to file a return for that year, you need to let them know. But you're kind of saying, well, that's not what I'm making now. That's what I made 2 years ago. So you could see how your premium could be adjusted up. Yeah, I made $250,000 that year, but right now I'm only making $30,000. So you could see how that's affecting your premium. If you amend, and let me just go back to that, to determine your 2019 income-related monthly adjustment amounts, they use the most recent tax return the IRS has provided to them. Generally, this information is from a return filed in 2018, which is for the 2017 year. So that's kind of a throwback. Well, that's, and here, because I get this, well, that's not what I'm making now. Now, if you amended your return, you need to let them know. Now, what if your income has gone down to, you've got lower income? Now, they're going to say here, I've got a list of the following things. Now, what they say is, if your income has gone down due to any of the following situations and the changes make a difference in income level, reach out to them. And there's a form for that as well. But let's say you married, divorced, or became widowed, might be one of the reasons your income has changed. You or your spouse stopped working or reduced your work hours. You or your spouse lost income producing property because of a disaster or other event beyond your control. You or your spouse experienced a schedule cessation, termination, or reorganization of an employer's pension plan, or you or your spouse received a settlement from an employer or former employer because of employer's closure, bankruptcy, or reorganization. So if any of that applies to you, they need documentation verifying the event and the reduction in your income. Documentation you provide should relate to the event and may include a death certificate, a letter from your employer about your retirement, or something similar. If you filed an income tax return for the year in question, you need to show us a signed copy of the return. Here's the form. And what I tell people is you need to reach out to Social Security and let them know your income has changed. And this is the form to do that. It's form SSA-44. SSA-44. And here's what it's called. Medicare Income Related Monthly Adjustment Amount. Life-changing event to report a major life-changing event. So if your income has gone down, you need to let them know, because that's why I went over that timing. They could be using and billing you based on information 2 years ago. This isn't like they know what's going on now. And if you're jacked up on premium, but now making a lot less money, you're going to need to reach out to the GIMP. So it's at socialsecurity.gov/forms/SSA-44.pdf. Just Google it, SSA-44.
Well, it sounds like...
I didn't mean to say Google, and now I've said it twice. I always like to say your search browser. Go search for it, but we know what everybody uses.
Well, you say they could be using information from 2 years ago. They're probably using information from 2 years ago.
Could be 3 years ago.
Yeah, especially if you're behind on your taxes. Well, you need to get that sucker filed. But one thing I was just amazed at there is I'm still learning stuff 10 years into this show. So you can get an amended Medicare premium if you have a rental property that gets wiped out in a flood.
Yeah.
You got to go fill out a form.
You're not wanting to give them heads up like your income's jumped up. Like, okay, I'm sorry. My income's like triple this year. I need you to start charging me more. They're going to catch up on that, believe me. But what happens is income's dropped. That premium is painful. where your income has dropped. And, you know, heck, $50 a month, $54.10 is a big deal. Wow. When you think, if you don't need to give away $54.10 a month, you might need to let them know that your premium has gone, your income's gone down to get you into the right premium classification.
I love that list, and I love the breakout here. Is there something you can send me, and we'll put this on GregoryRicks.com Monday? Because we'll do this on Monday's show, too. This is good enough that we got to get the word out on this.
Well, we'll see if we can do it. I don't know about reposting a government document here, but we probably will pull an article that talks about this and add to the web, to the blog.
I'm always impressed when I can learn something new on the show, Gregory.
So it's kind of two things about what, because I always say you have to make a decision to turn on Social Security, and file and suspend is something that causes an effect, means your Social Security is going to start at 70 for those that did that a few years back. And then here, there's a form to correct the billing on your Medicare Premium Part B.
Woo, a lot to digest there. A little bit of a college course we have going. Can I just cleanse our brain with something lighthearted real quick?
Okay.
All right, so a 7-Eleven is bringing Jarritos Mexican Soda. Are you familiar with this? J-A-R-R-I-T-O-S.
Jarritos?
Jarritos. You see it in the grocery store all the time.
Okay, I didn't know I saw it.
Well, you probably walked past it in the ethnic section. It's a lot more popular where I'm from, over in Texas.
Where I'm getting my taco kit from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm from North Mexico. Y'all call it Texas, but it's a lot more popular there. Well, they scored last year because tapping into the Latino market in America, they made a 7-Eleven Slurpee last year, or Jarritos Slurpee did real good. They're actually going to use Jarritos for the first time in one of the soda fountains.
Jarritos.
It's coming to the soda fountain. I'm going to try that out. It has real sugar, not the high fructose corn syrup. You might like it. Byron in Houma, you're on Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Byron?
Oh, how you doing? I'm going to be retiring in about 9 years, and I have rental property, and I'm not paying the 15% Social Security tax on it because you don't have to. Would it benefit me to start taking it in as income instead of, are you following my line of thinking?
Yeah, I get what you're asking, and depends on how you're structured. Your business, your real estate business, could be structured differently where you have a holding company that is taking that income, depending on how these properties are owned, if they're inside of LLCs and entities such as that. But you could also have a holding company that is taking that money in, and that company could be paying you a salary in a way that you're filing a return, even if it's self-employment, or it could be, say, a subchapter S corporation as an example, to then you're kicking out a payroll to yourself, which includes Social Security taxes and other things. And there's more to it when you're doing that. There's more there to pay than just Social Security taxes, but you could structure your business that way, and that would create benefits. Are you, and let me ask you this question, Byron, in a different way. Are you saving? You've got a real estate business generating you revenue. So this is your occupation, I assume.
Correct. Yeah. And it's my business that owns the property, and I'm incorporated. So my business is actually renting the property from me.
Okay.
To save the 15%.
Okay. So some people are doing things to work around to pay less of that or not pay it by having an entity structuring. They could have a lot of income, but they only payroll so much of that income to not maybe be on the maximum side of that. I'm structured, and one of the reasons I'm structured is, you know, I want to pay into it. Even back when I ran a small business and was considered self-employed a long time ago, I wasn't necessarily paying much into that or not. And my emphasis is, yeah, I want to be paying into that. That's one of I want to have that source of income.
So in 9 years, though, a 9 year period, but if I take that $24,000 and put it in, you know, claim it as income and start paying my 15% Social Security on it, is that going to make a significant difference? Do you have any idea how much longer it would take me to recoup the 15% that I would lose by going that route? The 15% I'm saving right now, how long would it take me to recoup that 15% of retirement benefits that I would gain?
So you're really talking about a shift of $3,600 a year based on what, 24,000?
No, you're talking it's going to go up to about, it's going to, my income will probably go up, it's almost doubling it.
Okay.
Now I'm also saving $2,000 a month, just putting it away. But,
okay. So you're also actually saving money for retirement. So you've got another business going on besides this rental business, right?
Right. Yeah.
Look, it does add towards your Social Security. You kind of have to look at what is your overall history. Are you paying into Social Security anyhow?
Yeah.
So you're talking about some.
I'm already paying it.
Okay. Here's where I'll go to this. I think this might also, because this deals with taxes, withholding, structuring of your business. And I think this probably is a conversation with your tax professional or CPA that you're working with is kind of where I think you need to have this conversation, because they know, and because ultimately what is Social Security? It's a tax, and it has to do with payroll deductions and such, and whoever's handling that, I think that's where they could help you out with the math of this. And have you signed up for your SSA account online?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay. So you can go online and look at your history of contributions and taxable earnings into Social Security. So that gives you an idea. Are you replacing early years? And if you are, you're incrementally increasing your Social Security benefits over time. So that's where I think you should head with this.
And what I'm saying is, I also have a business partner that's younger than me, and we're going to probably end up closing the business earlier than what he should, or he's going to have to buy me out or whatever. But I'm trying to think about him also. If we turn this on, you know, in other words, stop taking the rental income and turn it into regular income, so we start paying the Social Security tax on it.
Yeah, I'd go talk to your CPA about this, both of you in that case, because he needs to be thinking about the future, and it's good that you're thinking about him, but he needs to be thinking about him too. So hopefully this helps you. Thank you for calling Winning at Life.
At the last event for the decade, there was a bunch of comment cards that were filled out, and we're going to go through a couple of these questions right now. Actually, we'll just squeeze as many as we can into the rest of the show. But this comment card, the question is, I have inherited IRAs, best way to invest it. Now, what this sounds like to me is they don't understand, but they're really asking three different questions here. When you inherit an IRA, do you have to pay taxes on it? What's that transaction look like? When you inherit an IRA, what are the options on how you take distributions from it? And then when you inherit an IRA and you, after you take the distributions from it, where do you put that money from an investment standpoint?
First off, a question I think, is this a spouse that's inheriting the IRA, or is it a non-spouse? Because there's two different treatments there. If it's a spouse inheriting, it can basically move to that spouse's account because the spouse was the primary beneficiary, because IRAs go by contract, meaning there's a beneficiary designation. So it's going, can go and become the spouse's IRA. There's a number of reasons for that. It could just come over to that spouse as a Beni IRA. Most of the time it's switched to a spousal, so that money's basically melded with the spouse's IRA, is a simple way to explain that. So it's not a taxable event until that spouse starts taking distributions. And the spouse, because of the spousal option, does not have to take RMDs, required minimum distributions. Now, if it's a non-spouse beneficiary, say some other family member, children or friend, anybody other than the spouse, it's a non-spousal benefit. So what has to happen in either case, if they're over 70 and a half, that RMD has to be settled up for that year of death. Now, for a non-spouse beneficiary, they have to start taking required minimum distributions from that inherited account year after death. Now, they can't meld that money, mix that money with their own IRA. It has to stay a segregated, properly titled account, which means has information about the deceased in the title of that IRA. If it's done wrong, going to create you a tax problem later. Now, you have to take required distributions from that account year after death. And if you're a named beneficiary, it's going to be based upon your age, the in-person inheriting that account. And those are taxable distributions. Now, if that's a Roth IRA, it's not taxable, but a non-spouse has to take the RMDs from it. They have to take distributions, even though it is not a taxable account. Now, was part of the question, I explained a lot of tax stuff and requirements there, but were they also, how do I invest it?
Yeah, that was the second part. Best way to invest it?
With great care. It's an inherited account that represents somebody else working life, is how I look at that. I always think of inherited money as special money. And I always define this when there's, well, what should we do? You know, because sometimes the question is, should we take it and pay off the house and stuff like that? I said, when you're dealing with this, you think of that person and do good by that. And if that's prudent, it helps you financially going forward, paying off that house, paying off some debt. Those are good things to do with the money. It isn't an absolute, oh, you should go and invest this. And I don't think you should take excessive risk with inherited money. I think you need to be prudent and do good with that money, and it can last a long time. Info. Check us out at GregoryRicks.com.
Yeah, GregoryRicks.com. If you're interested in his day job, or his office number, 504-832-9200. Your home away from the show, winningatlife.com, and the Winning at Life app. I'm James Parker. We're Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.
Investment advisory services offered only by duly registered individuals through AE Wealth Management, LLC. AE Wealth Management, Gregory Ricks & Associates, W.J. Blanchard Law, LLC, J. Heath & Company, and Mortgage Gumbo are not affiliated companies. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any references to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products, never securities or investments. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims-paying abilities of the issuing carrier. This radio show is intended for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be used as the sole basis for financial decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual's situation. Annuities are insurance contracts designed for retirement or other long-term needs. They provide guarantees of principal and credited interest, subject to surrender charges. Annuity guarantees and protections are backed by the financial strength and claims paying ability of the issuing insurer. Hypothetical examples have been provided for illustrative purposes only. It does not represent a real-life scenario and should not be construed as advice designed to meet the particular needs of an individual situation. Gregory Ricks & Associates is not permitted to offer, and no statement made during the show shall constitute legal or tax advice. Our firm is not affiliated or endorsed by the U.S. government or any governmental agency. The information and opinions contained herein provided by third parties have been obtained from sources believed to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed by Gregory Ricks & Associates. We are Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.